this is Lina Miremont. I'm back with my show, Lina Live. I have exceptionally interesting show today with an outstanding person who is a doctor and actually the leader in the field, which we're going to discuss. We're going to talk about world of geriatrics. And my guest is Dr. Michael Steinman. He is an associate professor of medicine in the Department of Medicine of Division of Geriatrics of University of California, San Francisco. And in the program, I will call it as UCSF, so you will understand that that is an abbreviation for this hospital. Dr. Michael Steinman is my guest, who is the leader in this extremely powerful field, geriatrics, which has to do with older people, with medication, with all issues which has to do with the treatment, prescription of a medication, and pharmaceutical industry. Michael, you're welcome. And I like to take a privilege and to take advantage of your permission to call you by your first name, but not by any means to diminish the stature of your accomplishments, which are quite tremendous. We're going to touch on them during course of the program. And my first question, just as a, perhaps as an overview, starting your journey from Harvard Medical School and now continue your professional life in San Francisco, what made you to make a decision to be in that particular area of humanity?
Sure. I throughout medical school, as well as during residency, which is the period of training after medical school, I didn't have that much exposure to geriatrics. I certainly took care of a lot of older patients, including those who were frail or vulnerable, had dementia and other things which are commonly associated with people as they get old. But even though I saw a lot of those patients, there wasn't a lot of training in the specific competencies about how to care for the unique needs of older patients. That might be different from, say, a younger person who might have a heart attack or a stroke or diabetes or whatever problems I was treating. So I didn't really know that much about geriatrics, even though I took care of a lot of older people. But then almost by chance, I sort of found myself in a division of geriatrics because I wanted to do research around medication use in adults. And it turned out that some of the best research mentors and advisors for what I was interested in happened to be in a division of geriatrics. And it was this accident of my ending up in a division that gave me greater exposure to the specific issues that were relevant to the care of older adults. And that's how I ended up learning how to love geriatrics and to become a geriatrician myself.
I see. We're going to take steps along with your student years and your residence, and then perhaps you can fill us in with your gradual getting into the field and what you have discovered, and just to have an overall dynamic where you started and where you're now and what is your vision in the future. It's just, again, I'm coming back to the overview. So I would continue in mentioning that you did complete your residency in primary care of internal medicine in UCSF. My own conclusion would be that once you complete this residence, you already had quite a first-hand impression of your field and what does it take and where the problem lies. Am I right, or I'm a little bit premature because it was just a residence?
I think it's sort of yes and sort of no. I think there were certain issues that I was aware of that I was frustrated by, that many of my colleagues were frustrated by. For example, we would take care of an older person and they'd come into the hospital for a heart attack, for example, and we'd do all of our medicines and our treatments to treat the heart attack, and we'd be successful at that. But we knew that the heart attack was only one small part of their problems, that they had a lot of other things going on with their health and their life that we weren't really able to fully address, and we didn't have the tools to address. And so there were sort of things that we knew about that we didn't feel like we weren't fully capable of handling. Then there were some other issues which I think we just didn't even know that we didn't know. For example, one common problem in older people is delirium, which means when older people, particularly those who might be hospitalized or have dementia or other such things, suddenly take a turn for their worse in terms of how they're thinking, and they might become confused or disoriented. Sometimes when people do that, they get very agitated and they lash out. If you're in the hospital, you might start trying to get out of bed or talking in a way that doesn't make sense. But some other people just become very quiet and don't say anything at all and spend a lot of the time sleeping when they're delirious. And I myself didn't even recognize that that was a kind of delirium. So I didn't know that the patient had a problem, even though it was right in front of me. And my subsequent learning about geriatrics sort of taught me about both how to manage the kinds of problems that I could see in front of me, but also how to look for problems and identify issues that I didn't even know to look for before I started doing this.
If you permit me to give you very sincere, go way just beyond simple compliment, having a quality of a true thinking doctor, and you do have this very profound and very detailed human approach, which starts from the curiosity questions, taking time and taking these human patients, and then come to some kind of medical conclusion using your expertise or sometimes an intuition. If I may include a little personal story, I do not want to dwell much on that, but the reason I'm doing so because we all have older parents. Unfortunately, my parents passed away. But what you just described creates such a flashback, such experiences of total loss, of total disorientation, how to handle certain medical situations, because sometimes you really have to become a little doctor for one you very close to. And you reminded me of something which indeed happened to my father, who had an open heart surgery, and it prolonged his life for another 20 years. But at the time, he almost lost his life because it was a very, very mysterious, peculiar situation with his chronic pneumonia. And the solution was so simple. It was incredibly simple. He was allergic to Ativan, which is, if I pronounce correctly, is a tranquilizer. So once he was switched to another tranquilizer, he started to improve rapidly. Well, whether it's an allergy, whether it's some other things, it's a mystery. But he could not explain, even doctors could not explain. It's frankly between myself and a lung specialist started to think that something was something was in his lung situation when he could not breathe. So the reason I bring this up because your area of expertise is extremely touching to all of us who is indeed facing with taking care of, if not parents, it's relatives, and sometimes we do need this dialogue with the medical care personnel, and we don't quite know how to approach this. So jumping a little bit ahead, I will talk about some of your publications which you wrote with your other colleagues. And you indeed talk about clinical research of certain medications. In fact, you even have a archive of a drug industry document which will describe exactly how this medication was marketed, what was the tactics, what the medication is all about. So all of this ocean of information can be extremely useful and extremely helpful in a quite a desperate situation sometimes. So I like to come back to you and move on your next step, which I believe was a fellowship in USSF in the VA, which is Veterans Affairs National Quality Scholars Program, and also USSF Clinical Geriatrics Fellowship. What was your position and where you were with your research at that point?
Sure. So when I started, I did two fellowships back-to-back. And fellowship is basically an optional time of additional training after completing residency. So once I'd done my residency, and that basically gave me the training to go out and be a doctor, I was very interested in doing research. And as I mentioned before, I didn't have that much knowledge about geriatrics, but I knew I wanted to do research around medication use in adults. And and the kind of research I was interested in happened to be in a division of geriatrics under this program called the VA Quality Scholars Program. And basically what that program does is it provided an opportunity to combine the ability to work with leading national experts in research for the kinds of types of research I was doing, but it also had a particular focus on quality, both research about how to identify and then improve the quality of medical care that people get, but also not only to research that, but how to actually improve it, thinking ways about actually how to implement changes to improve quality of care, not necessarily for one person at a time, but how to change the healthcare system, for example, the hospital where I'm working or the clinic where I'm working or even my own type of practice in a way that improves quality of care for all the patients who I see or who are seen in the clinic or seen in the hospital. And it was this opportunity to combine research with this focus on quality that really was very appealing to me. It was through doing that research, and I started out with a particular focus on looking at antibiotic use in adults and looking at patterns of how people are using antibiotics and thinking about whether those were good or not good choices, about what medicines were or what antibiotics were being used to treat what kind of infections. And then it was from there that I got more interested in geriatrics, and I, over time, turned my attention away from looking specifically at adults in general and more focusing on the problems of medication use in vulnerable older adults.
You know, you mentioned an antibiotic, and if I can stretch and go a little bit beyond just geriatrics area, it is quite controversial medicine presently, because even though it's an absolute lifesaver in certain situations, needless to mention pneumonia and some other things, and created a revolution in the medicine, but overuse of the antibiotic became a common knowledge. And it is sometimes very challenging to determine, especially in children, chronic, for example, ear infection, whether it's a sterile fluid in the ear which creates pain or it is indeed an infection. And I wanted to ask you this question. When there is a call for an antibiotic, especially in elder people whose immune system is weaker and antibiotic choice becomes extremely critical, do you subscribe to the idea of take a culture, not only from the throat, but to get a culture actually from the lung itself to focus and to really make a best choice for that particular individual and for that particular type of pneumonia?
Yeah, I think in the case of pneumonia is a little different. There are certain situations where you can get where having a culture result is very helpful, and particularly have a urinary tract infection. So a urine infection is a good example of that because typically the urine is sterile. It should not grow bacteria. So if you collect a sample of urine and it grows a lot of bacteria, particularly if they're all just of one type, you're pretty confident that those are the bacteria which are causing the infection, and that helps you choose your antibiotic appropriately. The problem in the lung is to get access to the lung, you have to go through the mouth. And the mouth is full of all sorts of bacteria, which are normal, which, you know, everyone has bacteria in their mouth, and that's normal and just part of being human. So the difficulty is when you try to get a sample of sputum from the lung, it becomes contaminated with all of the stuff that's in the mouth. And so when you get the results of your culture, you might see a lot of bacteria there, but it's hard to know if they're truly the bacteria that's causing the pneumonia or whether it's just the bacteria which are naturally there in the mouth anyways. So for most situations, I do not get a sputum culture for people with pneumonia because I don't think it's very helpful. It can be misleading, and oftentimes it's usually not helpful. There are a few certain circumstances for people who are very sick in the hospital, who have an infection that's very hard to treat, who you might go down and actually stick like a narrow tube down into the lung to try to get an accurate sample. But that's a pretty focused and narrow case. For most people who are see their doctor in the clinic, or even most people in the hospital with pneumonia, I do not think that sputum cultures are particularly helpful.
It's a very interesting and a very clear explanation, especially because there is a confusion between viral infection, and which is very difficult to attack, and infection. I'm saying it in an extremely simple term, but you really brought the another issue, which created my next question. Older people have more of an unfriendly infection in general. Is it challenging for you to indeed find appropriate medication which will take into consideration the fact of overall picture of older person with a focusing on particular medical issue?
For an infection, do you mean a particular?
Yes, for the infection, yes.
Yeah. It sometimes can be more challenging in older people, and there's a few reasons for that. Older people often take many medicines, and sometimes the medicines that you're taking might have an interaction with the antibiotic. It doesn't mean that you can never take that antibiotic, but you don't want to cause a problem by having the two drugs interact with each other and you know, maybe increase risk of causing harm or side effects. That's one problem. Another problem is that in older people, particularly people who have been in the hospital a lot, they tend to get infected with more aggressive or bacteria that are harder to treat. Because there's a lot of antibiotic use in hospitals and nursing homes, a lot of the bacteria that live there have become resistant to many antibiotics. So if I'm taking care of someone, say, who lives in a nursing home, or say was recently in the hospital and then they went home and then they got an infection, I have to be worried that maybe the bacteria that's causing that infection is resistant to many of the antibiotics that I would usually use. And so you might be, you know, often would choose to use a more an antibiotic that kills many, many different types of bacteria just to make sure that I'm getting the bacteria that's causing the problem for that patient. The challenge with that is some of those antibiotics can be very expensive. They also can be difficult to take. Some of them might even require having an IV going directly into the blood. So there are more considerations that you have to think about in older people. There are many situations where it's pretty straightforward. Someone who comes in with a simple urinary infection, you know, that's not especially complicated to treat. But there are many situations in which there's a lot of factors that need to be considered.
I certainly have a great anticipation of discussing the the segment which would have to do with medical care, which you already mentioned, something which is such a burning issue for all of us, especially older people. And we certainly will talk about some marketing positive and negative aspects with the role of pharmaceutical industry in the connection with the influencing doctors and making them somewhat obey some pharmaceutical policy, which very, very important to understand, to be aware of. So I just like to take a little break to give our very special guest, Dr. Michael Steinman, a little breath of music air. And after that, we will come back with our discussion with many more important critical issues, which has to do with the health and welfare of older people. Discussion with Dr. Michael Steinman, who is a specialist on very important field no one can avoid, is getting old. Michael, I like to shift gears of conversation on pharmaceutical industry. I have to confess, I was surprised how brave you were when you indeed made a strong point how pharmaceutical industry is influencing doctors and making quite a strong impact on their attitude towards prescribing the medication. I don't really have specific question, just an overall concept, how bad that is.
I think it's a big issue, and I think it's a big problem in many ways. You know, drug companies do a lot of really good things. Drug companies make the drugs that we need to improve people's health. And so there's an absolutely critical role for drug companies in the healthcare system. The problem, though, is that drug manufacturers are for-profit companies, and they are responsive to the needs of their shareholders, and that means that they need to make a profit. And there are two ways they can make a profit. They can create really good products which serve a very useful role in the treatment of patients and that are much better than the alternatives, or they can get doctors to prescribe their products regardless of whether or not they're good or helpful or effective. Either way, if the doctor is prescribing the drug, that generates revenue for the company and they make money. So companies, I think, want to do the right thing and make, you know, truly good breakthrough products, but, you know, those are hard to do. And so companies also try to sell the products that they have as much as they can, even though they might not actually be the best drugs for patients. And there's a bunch of ways that they do that. And the drug industry is involved in almost every facet of the healthcare system, and the ways that doctors practice is very strongly influenced in many ways by drug companies. Not because drug companies are paying doctors money to prescribe their drugs. It's not that direct. But there are many ways in which drug companies sort of control the educational content about what doctors are exposed to, create incentives for doctors to prescribe their drugs, develop relationships with doctors where doctors get gifts or some kind of inducement from companies. That's not a bribe, but it creates a feeling of goodwill from the doctor towards that company and will make that doctor more likely to prescribe the drug. So there's a lot of, and the research often is organized by drug companies, not in a way that is scientifically false, but there's a lot of ways of taking the research and directing it in a certain way that's going to make your company's product look good. So all of these different mechanisms are used by drug companies to try to increase how often doctors prescribe their drugs. And sometimes that's for the good of patients, but sometimes it's not for the good of patients. And we need to be vigilant about allowing good prescribing to continue while improving prescribing that's not so good.
I, again, cannot admire you enough for being so frank, honest, professional, objective, and helpful. I had a thought coming from Eastern Europe myself about role of marketing in this country, especially in modern digital reality, that marketing became more important than our human breath. It's a computer breath more important than our human benefits. And just remembering some time ago, I was reading about a little bit about history of marketing and how it was developed, because after all, it's the most natural instinct to say and to share something what you have with belief or with the goodness of it. But it became somewhat so aggressive sometimes with a bit of a vulgarity attached to it that we became captive with, instead of information, is misinformation. And the history actually was much more promising when, I believe, around 19th century, Mr. Palmer established first roots of modern advertising agency in Philadelphia. He just bought large amount of space in various newspapers to advertise whatever he felt sincerely would be fantastic for people. And now we have to spend so much time to sort this information, to get information off in the information, and then even after that, we still cannot get to the root of the issue because we're not specialists in the field like yourself. So one of the things I'm personally so grateful for the fact that you're participating is because you really explained the mechanism, how is this chain is working. And yes, there is a very eloquent way to seduce the doctors and convince them, not bribing them directly, but ingenuity of this seduction becoming more important than really care for the patient. But you did explain this very, very clearly. I'd like to move to another subject. Your student training, I believe that in UCSF, you are site director for the medical student training in aging. Are you still involved in that?
Yes, I am.
Well, I don't know how you're doing all of these things, but obviously you do, and you even found the time to participate in this program, which, again, once more, I am extremely grateful. We all are. Speaking about young students, how difficult it is to give this information to a young mind who doesn't feel he or she ever will become old?
Well, it's an interesting question. I think, you know, people who are younger have less personal experience with this. You related the story about dealing with, you know, your father. And many people, as they get older, they have their parents experience these problems with aging, so they see firsthand what the kind of issues are. But someone who's 20 or 22 or 25 or 30 for that matter, their parents are probably still pretty healthy, and they might have a grandparent who's getting old, but maybe not, or maybe they don't have that close contact. So I think there is something really to be said about having personal experience, you know, in your own personal life, which makes a big impression on how you treat patients. But that said, the flip side of that is that, you know, the medical training is that you learn certain ways of thinking about things. You learn certain ways of approaching patients. And one of the great things about working with medical students, particularly medical students just in their first or second year of medical school, is that they're open to all sorts of new ideas and they're fresh and they haven't had their thinking sort of conditioned in a certain way. So they're very open to different approaches to thinking about patients and to considering the role of aging in a way that someone who's already been through 3 or 5 or 10 years of training might not be as open to. Not because they're bad people, because they've already developed a way of thinking and it's harder to kind of shift that midstream. So there's a real beauty to working with the younger students and kind of helping to launch their medical careers and provide that aging perspective early on, which can really help to be integrated with the other things that they're learning so that they can really provide the best care for their older patients, you know, who they will undoubtedly see in their future professional career unless they're a pediatrician.
You know, we don't certainly have enough connection between psychological, sometimes even human integration with a medical condition. It is getting better. And of course, I'm not in the medical field per se, but dealing with the performing arts people who are facing sometimes with a physical challenges in their own rights, and they have to go on the stage, and they are dealing with a certain medications and then side effects of it. I believe that what you just described, again, so eloquently about approaching young people, I can relate to as well, because sometimes young person would not be as nearly as careful as he or she should be with taking medication, with even having an elementary patience to have this medication. They feel, oh, this is a non-prescriptive medication, so this is fine. There's no harm to it. And I always would stress the fact that it is with it doesn't require prescription does not really excuse anyone to take it as a harmless vitamin C. In fact, even an overdose of vitamin C can be harmful. My question is, how do you see the industry with non-prescription medication, and how do you feel that one should be really aware of this? Because I believe that there are much more medications just in a drugstore, and sometimes we will take it and we see it as a new name, quite powerful with the side effects, but people don't pay attention to this. They want to relieve symptoms very quickly, and they think, well, I do not need to go to the doctor, I just need to go to the drugstore. Your comments on that?
Right. No, I think it's a very good point that, you know, medicines are medicines, and, you know, all medicines have side effects, including drugs you need a prescription for and drugs that you don't need a prescription for. And there can be quite serious side effects from common over-the-counter medicines, ibuprofen, which is also known as Motrin, Aleve or Naprosyn, diphenhydramine or Benadryl. All of these drugs can have quite serious side effects. Now, of course, it's not for everyone. Many people take them safely. I've certainly taken these drugs myself. You know, but just because they're sold over the counter doesn't mean that you can take them and not have to worry about anything. So I think there's sort of two things to think about when taking an over-the-counter medicine. First is that when you see your doctor, make sure to tell the doctor about all the medicines you're taking, not just the ones that a doctor prescribed, but the ones that you're buying at the drugstore or the ones that you might be buying at the natural food store or from your herbal medicine or natural medicine. You know, because all of those things, even if it's an herb, you know, that's a drug. It's something you're putting in your body. And it's important for your doctor to know about everything you're taking, not just about the drugs that require a prescription from a doctor. The second thing is just to be careful with these drugs and to look at the warnings on them. Make sure to take them as directed. Don't just be popping those pills. You know, make sure that you don't take more than is directed, and look at the warnings on the box to see if there's a problem that you should be aware of, or maybe if you have a certain condition, then maybe the use of the drug is not recommended. You can also go on the internet and look at some sites. There's a site in particular that I recommend for people that's run by the National Institutes of Health. It's called Medline Plus, and that provides information about drugs that's prepared by the National Institutes of Health, and it's unbiased, and it's provided good information that people can use to learn about the medicines they're taking.
Wonderful to have this comment, especially immediate practical help with this Medline Plus. I confess I was visiting this myself in a few occasions. It is a very clear site, and you can navigate relatively simply. Michael, there is one segment of your activities which I read about, and I'm going to pronounce it, but not a single word I understand. So I would need a translation of the probably something very significant which you involved in. You're director for comparative effectiveness research for UCSF's Clinical and Translational Science Institute. Please translate that. What is this about?
It's a long title. I think the key part of that is the first part, which is comparative effectiveness research. And what that role means is I help the UCSF, like many large research universities, has sort of a infrastructure to help with research. And as part of that infrastructure, they have different people working on different kinds of research and different programs. And so my role is to work on this specific kind of research called comparative effectiveness research. Now, comparative effectiveness research basically is research that compares one treatment against another treatment. It sounds pretty obvious, but historically what's happened is that when people, say, research new drugs, they compare the use of that drug against a placebo, against a sugar pill. And that tells you if the drug works better than taking no drug at all. But what it doesn't tell you, if there might be five available drugs that might treat the medical problem that you have, it doesn't say which of those five drugs is the best for you. All that you can know from that is that each of those five drugs is better than a sugar pill. So comparative effectiveness research really focuses on comparing drugs and treatments and all sorts of different kinds of things we can do to help people, not against a sugar pill, but against each other, to see of all the available options, which is going to be the best for patients. The other part of that is to realize there's not one single answer. There might be certain kinds of patients for whom a certain drug is most effective, but there might be other kinds of patients in whom another drug is most effective. So the key in this research is not only comparing one treatment against each other for everyone mixed together, but trying to see, are there certain types of patients for whom one drug might be best and other types of patients for whom another drug might be best. And it seems obvious, and it should be obvious, but these are things which have historically not been a strong part of research. And there's really been a strong push in the last few years to try to increase the amount of research done to answer these kinds of questions, which are very relevant to what doctors need to know and what patients need to know to get the best care possible.
You just brought another whole tree of questions and thoughts I have, but we always have to measure this with a time. And I have to say that our time is coming to the end, and I just wanted to express a couple of thoughts and to leave a little bit time in asking you non-threatening but personal questions, because we all want to know who is Dr. Michael Steinman is in terms of his education, perhaps his parents, someone who influenced in his life, or was just pure gradual formation of this interest towards geriatrics. So I would say, before I will give you this opportunity to conclude our program, I just wanted to say that there is obvious connection, at least in my mind, that longevity and the fact that people live longer and the fact that there is a certain accumulation of knowledge from other science makes your research somewhat more dynamic, perhaps sometimes more exciting, but maybe more challenging. If you can comment on this, and then we'd like to hear a little bit about your personal story.
Sure. Maybe I can skip to the it's hard to know how to comment on that first thing because it's such a broad area, but maybe I'll just tell you something briefly about my own personal story. Is that so? My father is a doctor, and my mother is a social worker, and I think that growing up in that household made a strong influence on me to be a doctor and to be a researcher. And, you know, and even though they seem like they might be two very different professions, being a doctor and a social worker, I think they're actually in many ways related. And I see a lot of what I do as sort of merging these two areas. You know, as a doctor, I know about medicines and different treatments, and I can understand laboratory tests and x-rays. But there's a lot of things which I do, and which we all do as doctors, which don't depend on giving a drug or giving, you know, or understanding what a lab test means. But it means on working with people to understand what's going on in their lives and to find, to help to understand how their life situation is affecting their disease. And also, what are going to be the best ways to treat their disease given what's going on in their life. And sometimes that can involve the choice of a certain drug, but sometimes it can involve other things that don't involve drugs at all, about exercise, about diet, or if the patient needs to take drugs, finding ways to help them take the drugs consistently. Because just because I prescribe a drug doesn't mean someone's going to take it. They need to want to take it and to know how to take it. So a lot of what I do combines not only sort of my father's side of the equation, what we traditionally think of as a doctor, but my mother's side in terms of working with people to understand what's going on in their lives and to use that to help to treat their illness, but also to think about the big picture. When I'm treating someone's diabetes, my goal is not to get their blood sugar down. My goal is to help them have a longer life and a higher quality of life and be able to do the things that they want to do with their life. And so it's kind of keeping your eyes on sort of the big picture. That is something I've learned a lot from my mother, as well as my social work colleagues and my geriatrics colleagues. And it's something that I think I really kind of grew up in that my household, and I've sort of taken forward into my medical career.
Michael, very last question, and after you inspired me with your very comprehensive answer, which had human and medical drive, you made it very logically connected, but on a human level. And it is important, our background, regardless what profession we're in, we somehow combine all these different routes, creating our own journey. If put for one moment everything on the side, what would be the most important personal quality you would say in human for you?
Kindness.
Michael,
that goes a long way.
I am, for change, speechless. I thank you for your answer. Mostly thank you for what you're doing, and even with more gratitude that you again found the time from your extremely multi-task life in world of the most precious people who really deserve to have a conclusion of their life with most comfort and thoughtfulness. and you're certainly one of the best people who are providing this for them. My personal thanks, thanks from all of us. That was my program with Dr. Michael Steinman, who is one of the leaders in research and practical application for geriatrics, people for whom we have special care. Michael, we are waiting for your book. I'm sure you will try to find a time for this. You have so much to say, and I thank you again for the participation.
Thank you for having me.